really talk to clients a lot, whether they're, you know, potential clients or even, you know, existing clients. Develop your career. Learn about, you know, the sport you're covering or the multitude of sports you're covering. Be as good looking as possible. This is a visual medium. Lose weight if necessary. We employ a full-time stylist here. Make sure you're wearing the right clothing. Make sure your voice is good. We employ a full-time voice coach here. We have two alums of Newhouse who are just in development. So that's a big, huge part for us, whether you're going to be on 120 Sports doing it digitally, or you're going to be on Apple TV, or you're going to be on ESPN. You got to be good at what you're doing.
Here's the thing, though. We don't have a say in who the network hires, right? In the television business, the network is king. You know, they buy who they want to buy. And for any agent to sit back and say, yeah, we have a ton of power, yeah, that's sort of chest pumping. We don't. It'd be great to have power to determine who a television executive hires, but this business is a client business. You know, the agent works for the client.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And this week we're going a little bit off the board, where we're not interviewing two members of the sports media. We're interviewing two people who represent many members of the sports media. I'm going to talk to some agents, and I think you're going to find this really, really interesting. First up is Steve Herz. He is the president of IF Management. That is a boutique firm with about 150 clients. His clients include Dan Shulman and Jessica Mendoza of Sunday Night Baseball, ESPN's Seth Greenberg, NBC's Liam McHugh, ESPN's Maria Taylor, has Dave Revson at the Big Ten Network. Joe Davis is one of his clients at now calling Dodger games. And on the news side, Clarissa Ward at CNN, who I think is Steve Herz's best client, formerly of 60 Minutes, phenomenal journalist, and David Faber at CNBC, among many others. So Steve will be first up talking about the business. After Steve, we go to Matt Kramer of CAA, Creative Artists Agency, a massive, massive firm. I'm not even sure actually how many clients they have, but it's a ton. Some of Matt's individual clients are Adrian Wojnarowski, Doris Burke of ESPN, Marty Smith of ESPN. We should mention, obviously, Woj is from Yahoo and arguably the preeminent NBA newsbreaker that is out there. So Matt can talk about the business from a very big agency position. Prior to joining CAA, Matt was at a firm in Atlanta for, I think, 8 or 9 years, a smaller one, and so built his client base from that and then jumped to CAA about a year from now. I think you'll find it very interesting just in terms of how both these guys answered questions. One guy's from a smaller firm in Steve, one guy's from a bigger firm in Matt, and I think both were really, really interesting, but I think their answers also reflected where they're who their employers are. So so this is a little bit different. I don't expect it to get as many downloads as Brent Musburger or Sean McDonough, but the idea of this podcast is to try to let you under the roof a little bit. And these conversations did that, from from what the salary structures are at all these places to the gender wage gap between women in sports media and men in sports media, to agents telling their clients to lose weight, to change their appearance. We try to get honest on this podcast, so I think you're going to find it interesting. All right, now we'll bring on Steve Herz of IF Management. All right, and now we bring in Steve Herz of IF Management, somewhere in beautiful metropolitan New York City. Steve, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Richard. Great to be here.
Steve, this is an interesting topic to me. It's certainly inside baseball. It's not going to draw the kind of numbers that a known broadcaster or a known sports writer would. But I think it's the idea of this podcast to talk to two agents is to give some insight into what really happens behind the scenes, and hopefully maybe educational for those who want to get into the business. So as a general question to start off, Steve, how do you find your clients?
Well, Richard, at this point, I've been in this business now for 25 years, and I'm actually celebrating in a couple of weeks the 20th anniversary of IF Management. And so I think at this point, the majority of our clients are referrals, you know, kind of word of mouth, mostly through existing clients, some through certain executives and just people we know in the industry. Because we sort of have, for better or worse, you know, we kind of have a niche in the industry. We're kind of we like to think we're a high-end boutique, and people know the kind of people we look for. So that's sort of been the majority. But we do quite a bit of recruiting still. You know, we go to industry events and we go to, you know, kind of the RTNDA conferences, the sports Emmys. We go to the ESPYs. We're at the NBA finals, at the All-Star game, things like that. And you recruit people through those channels as well.
Steve, if CAA is, I mean, a very, very big agency, do you describe IF as a mid-sized agency, a small agency? I like the idea of you calling it a boutique. But in terms of numbers, could you give listeners a sense of how many active clients you would have at once?
Yeah, we have 150 clients in the agency, and we've been here, like I said, 20 years. And I'd say, you know, 10 years ago, by comparison, we probably had 120 clients. So we've really made a concerted effort not to grow quantitatively. We've tried to grow qualitatively throughout the years. Even if you go back 15 years, we probably had 80 clients. So we've made a real concerted effort. We're not going to handle more than probably 30 clients per agent here. That's been kind of the, you know, like if you go to college, there's something called the student faculty ratio. We want to have a student faculty ratio here of no more than 30-1.
What percentage from clients do you take as a general rule contractually?
What percentage do we take? Oh, you know, it's usually 10%, you know, overall. I mean, over the years, there have been some exceptions to that, yes. But I'd say the vast majority of our clients are at the 10% range. And people, I don't think people come to us because we're the low-cost provider at all. It's not like people say, oh, you know, we're not really, to the extent we're competing with IMG, CAA, William Morris, all these other companies, we're not competing on price. We're really competing on service.
If I wanted you to take a look at the industry for a moment. If I'm a 25-year-old man or woman who wants to make it in the sports media, whether I want to go into the broadcast space, the digital space, but, you know, I want a front-facing career.
Yep.
What advice would you give them today in terms of where you think the jobs are going to be tomorrow?
Well, it's a good question, and I've been thinking about this, obviously, not just because we were going to talk, but also just in general. I think that at the end of the day, the most important advice I think you could give somebody is to get really good on, I won't say on television, on camera, get good at being compelling, whether you're going to be performing. I mean, you think about it right now. Lin-Manuel Miranda is blowing everybody away in Hamilton. That guy would have been great in vaudeville. He would have been great in the 50s TV. If you have talent, you have talent. And I think that's transcendent through whatever medium you're communicating through. So my advice to somebody is make sure you get good at your craft. And that craft is to be interesting, to be compelling. And so I don't know if you mind me going into this right now.
Sure,
so cut me off if I'm, you know, we really talk to clients a lot, whether they're, you know, potential clients or even, you know, existing clients. Develop your career. Learn about, you know, the sport you're covering or the multitude of sports you're covering. Be as good looking as possible. This is a visual medium. Lose weight if necessary. We employ a full-time stylist here. Make sure you're wearing the right clothing. Make sure your voice is good. We employ a full-time voice coach here. We have two alums of Newhouse who are just in development. So that's a big, huge part for us, whether you're going to be on 120 Sports doing it digitally, or you're going to be on Apple TV, or you're going to be on ESPN. You got to be good at what you're doing.
It's interesting, Steve, because I want to get into this. You know, in knowing I was going to talk to you, I talked to a couple of people who are considered talent, talked to some people who work within the different sports media organizations in talent offices. And so I got a number of questions that I think are interesting. You just sort of brought something up about the aesthetics part of the business. As an agent, have you ever suggested to a client to either lose weight or get plastic surgery or change something about their appearance?
I have. One of my favorite examples is a client of ours who is now a morning anchor in Pittsburgh. And he came to us, this is probably 5 years ago, in Shreveport, Louisiana. And he was 40 pounds overweight. And I said, look, I didn't choose this life. You know, I love the line from The Sopranos. We chose this life. You know, don't complain about it. As a guy who has struggled with weight all my life myself, like, I'm not on television. I'm not in this business. So I don't have to worry if I have a few extra pounds on me. And yeah, there are certain people who can get away with being overweight. But I think it's like anything else. You give yourself the best chance to succeed. And for this guy, he was a little bit, obviously, outside the bell curve of what's acceptable. And, you know, he lost 40 pounds and the guy quadrupled his salary within 2 years. So you love examples like that. I mean, yeah, there are, I don't think I've ever gone to the extreme of telling someone to get plastic surgery, but certainly if you've got crooked front teeth, yeah, go see a great dentist. I mean, a lot of people might find that offensive, but the reality is that I try and we try here at IF to tell people things that other people are saying behind their back, but won't tell them to their faces.
That's interesting, Steve. What does that say about the profession? I'm not making a pejorative statement, but what does it say that a guy can drop 40 pounds and double his salary independent of the content, or quadruple his salary independent of the content that he's putting on air?
Well, he quadrupled his salary because he went from a small market to a much bigger market.
Okay, so there's a fact.
What it says about the business is just that it's really just a reflection of human nature. I mean, it's why if you watch Game of Thrones, all the actors and actresses from the imaginary Middle Ages are all incredibly good looking, you know, except for a few. It's why the leading ladies of Hollywood are gorgeous and why the leading men are very handsome. It's just the way our society is. And look, I have a lot of problems with a lot of the way our society is, but I did not, you know, get into this business, you know, to create a social justice, agency. I'm a capitalist, and our clients ultimately want to succeed. And I can't fight every rule. So, you know, we just kind of have to go with reality here.
It's interesting. I want to sort of get into this a little bit. How often do you have conversations with clients about age, about gender, about race and ethnicity in terms of what you hear from potential employers when that becomes a factor? And by the way, it shouldn't be a factor, but if we're going to be honest and deal straight, it's very clear that there is ageism, especially in sports broadcasting. There's certainly gender issues in sports broadcasting. And I would certainly argue, too, that there are probably places where race and ethnicity in sports broadcasting become a factor, too.
The answer to your question is as needed. I think that for better or worse, you know, and I think you know Josh and you know Gideon and Jeff, the guys in my office, we've all been together for many years. And I give those guys a lot of credit because they are absolutely of the same ilk that I am, even more so. We will never withhold information from a client, even if it gets very uncomfortable, if we think it's in the best interest of the client. And sometimes you even lose a client because of it. But you rather do that than withhold information that you think is dangerous for them not to know. So I'll give you one example. It just happened literally last week. We have a new client recently signed, a sportscaster in, I would say a small market, but maybe a top 20 TV station in the 20s. And this individual has a name of African descent from I believe she's a Nigerian, and we've gotten some feedback from this from a few different media executives. I like this person, but I think she should change her name. Wow. And it's a very uncomfortable conversation, as you can imagine. And she rightfully has a lot of pride in her name. It's hard to pronounce. And so that's been a very difficult conversation we've had with her over the last few weeks. And look, to her credit, she said, look, I'm not changing my name. And it may hurt her. And it's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous that it might hurt her. But at least everything's on the table now. Everybody knows the reality of the situation. And then it's the client's decision to do what he or she might want to do in a given circumstance.
I'm not going to lie to you. That pisses me off to no end that kind of nonsense exists. But I will say I respect your agency for, if nothing else, dealing with that client straight and saying, here's what people in the market are saying, and there might be some repercussions for you if you don't change your name in terms of moving up or in terms of airtime. But man, Steve, I'm not going to lie, that's a factor in 2016 is just feels like such an absurdity to me.
Look, there's an expression, you don't want to see how the sausage is made in the sausage factory.
Right.
I would say that I don't eat sausage anymore.
Would your firm take on a client such as Emily Austin, who recently, if you sort of follow the sports media space, you know she went on Barstool Sports for a Facebook live chat and dropped a lot of racism to different ethnic groups?
I think the answer is it depends. I've been following that case very carefully, and honestly, special thanks to you. I really think you've done a great job reporting that. I thought you really gave a very balanced account of everything. And the answer is maybe. I'm not a believer that a person should be given a scarlet letter and tarnished for the rest of their life for an indiscretion. Now, I also am a big believer in the First Amendment. And look, full disclosure, it might come as a huge shock to you. I'm Jewish, and I know a lot of what she said could be perceived or was definitely anti-Semitic in nature. So, you know, even despite that, I don't think a person should be judged by one 5-minute moment of their life. So yes, should she be punished? And this might sound, you know, counterintuitive, but I think she should have been fired, but I don't necessarily think she should be labeled an outcast for the rest of her life.
If obviously Emily Austin is an outlier because she was a contract player for a Fox regional, a smaller Fox regional. She doesn't have a big name nationally. So she doesn't have the kind of resume and probably firepower to overcome that kind of mistake in market. My question for you, though, would be, let's say Steve If is representing an ESPN anchor who goes on some niche website and does the same thing. What would you be doing in your role? And let's say the ESPN anchor is, it's not Chris Berman, but it's a well-known person. They're in the middle of a contract. Obviously, ESPN management is furious. What would be your role in that situation,
in real time a couple of years ago, which was a little more complicated because it was not, I don't think it was racist, but it was perceived by some when Doug Gottlieb, you know, spoke about, you know, the white man's perspective.
Correct.
You know, I think that at the end of the day, if you make a mistake, or even if you don't intend to make a mistake, you have to take full ownership of it and just understand that, you know, we're living in a world right now. And look, I don't agree with all of it. I don't agree with some of the limitations on the First Amendment and some of the, you know, kind of the stoning that comes out for people who offend others. First Amendment wasn't designed, free speech isn't abridged by what someone's offended by. You know, the only limits are hate speech and, you know, if you're going to cause violence on someone. But you take ownership of it and you own it and you move on, you know, and hopefully, as it happened in Doug's case, you know, he moved on from it because it doesn't represent the totality of who he is by a long shot. And so hopefully the person in your example has that equity in the marketplace with both their bosses and with the audience to know that this isn't the sum of who they are. Emily Austin doesn't have that going for her.
Yeah. Doug's situation is interesting. Do you currently represent him anymore? I know he moved from your agency to CAA. Is he?
We're jointly representing him with CAA. Oh, so yeah, there's a relationship there.
That's interesting. The joint thing. All right. Well, forgetting about or sort of using Doug as a jumping off point, but not specific to him. How competitive is this business? And you are an agency that, because of your size, I imagine would be of interest to larger agencies to try to poach your clients. So how do you feel about the whole idea of a bigger agency like a CAA type trying to poach your clients?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it, you know, because we're living in the ocean, right? And we're sort of, I would say, to the middle, or maybe the top end of the middle of the ocean, you know, if we're talking about fish. And we're not a sponge, but we're not a shark. And so obviously we're somewhere in that ecosystem. I don't think you get the benefit of being able to build a moat around your business. And in this world, everything's competitive. And just because you drive a Ford doesn't mean you should drive a Ford for the rest of your life. If Chevy comes out and makes a better product, you know, people should be able to go drive a Chevy. And I think it's true of agents as well. I don't like I think we've been very lucky. We, like I said, we've been in business for 20 years. The vast majority of our clients, the Dave Revsons, the Dan Schulmans of the world, have been with us for almost, and some, you know, exactly 20 years. So we've had a lot of loyalty. But loyalty shouldn't come just because, you know, you should have to do a good job. So I think that we work to get better and try to provide a better product. And at the end of the day, that's what competition is. So we don't shy away from it. And it's just part of the reality of any business. I think McDonald's is probably killing Burger King way worse than CAA is trying to do to people like us.
One of the things I told you when we spoke prior to this podcast was I would not ask you specifics about clients in terms of salary, et cetera. One, you're not going to answer them, and two, I think that's just only fair on my part. But I do want to ask you, as a general rule, because I think it's really educational and informative to the listeners in terms of salary structures at places. So as a general rule, Steve, if I'm a sports broadcaster at a regional outlet, a Comcast in Boston, a Fox Sports affiliate in Florida, an SNY in New York, a Time Warner in Los Angeles, roughly what is my salary if I'm an on-air person there?
I would say on the very, very low end, if you're entry-level person, you're looking at the low six-figure, you know, $100,000 to $125,000. You know, first job, first in the door, maybe, you know. And then I'd say, depending on the regional, the general high end on these jobs is probably a little south of $300,000. There's going to be a few outliers. I don't want to mention names. Some of them aren't my clients, but I know in Philadelphia, there's some people making, you know, pretty well north of that. But, you know, I'd say giving 100 to 300 is a pretty fair range to think about in terms of those jobs.
Okay, let's then go to that's interesting. Let's then go to the ESPNs and the Fox Sports ones of the world, eliminating the really high level Troy Aikman, Chris Collinsworth, John Gruden types. If I'm an ex-athlete coming in and I'm an analyst there and I'm doing games on, I'm like the number four college football person, or I'm the number three college basketball person. What kind of salary am I looking at if I'm at ESPN or FS1? And I'm going to do this for a couple different positions, but if I'm, this is specific to an ex-coach, an ex-GM, an ex-player who's doing live games as an analyst on the number three, number four team.
Well, it's an interesting question. It's a broad range. I mean, at ESPN, you can find people making anywhere on the low end, like $2,500 a game, maybe even less, depending on whether they're doing it for ESPNU or SEC. And then, you know, relatively decent jobs as these guys move up the ladder. It can be, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 an event. You know, and obviously there are guys that are making $15,000, $20,000, $30,000 an event, depending on who they are and their stature. But if you're looking in that, you know, you're talking about the lunch pail guy, that's, I think, a fair range, you know, $2,500 to $5,000 or $6,000 a game until the guy has broken out of that.
Yeah, it's still pretty good money, by the way. Significantly good money. All right, now let's go to the Sports Center level. Fox Sports 1 doesn't have this anymore, but it would have been like an America's Pregame or something like that. So if I'm a Sports Center anchor, I'm not Scott Van Pelt, I'm not Hannah Storm, I'm not someone who obviously is negotiated with the highest levels of ESPN for really significant seven-figure salaries. But if I'm part of that rotation, and I don't want to name any names because it wouldn't be fair to them, but if I'm part of the SportsCenter rotation, but I am not one of the people that they're really sort of pushing marketing-wise, what kind of salary per year am I looking at?
You know, it's a good question. I think you've seen a lot of attrition there over the last few years, because I think that even if you're a guy making $300,000 there, unless you've, you know, created a spot for yourself, they probably, you know, I don't put words in ESPN's mouth, but, you know, we obviously deal with them quite a bit. You know, sort of the mindset is they'd rather find a guy that they're going to pluck out of Topeka and pay $125 to $154 rather than keep the guy at the 300 range, unless he's either a guy they think has high upside or he's broken out and done something where he has kind of his own, you know, piece of turf.
Okay, that's, and again, SportsCenter anchors, because this, you know, I mean, it just, it, the range is so different from, you know, a Van Pelt to John Buchgras, obviously, who's got a lot of standing, to, you know, you keep going down the list, Kevin Connors, et cetera. And that's no knock to Kevin Connors. It's just, I'm talking about sort of Q rating stuff. I'm very interested in the opinion space, Steve, whether that's on an ESPN radio or Fox Sports radio, or the obviously the new FS1 shows that are coming, or ESPN 2's block, whether it's the His and Hers First Take and shows like that. A lot of these people are former print people or former digital columnists who've switched over to television. Again, I realize that the salaries will be very different given ages, given stuff. But can you give me a sense of, this is a two-part question, can you give me a sense of, one, where you see this high, heavy opinion space going on TV, and two, what kind of salaries are people looking at in that space?
It's a good question. I think that it's a two-part question, so I'll take them one at a time. The answer to the first question is, I don't really know in terms of where this whole opinion thing is going. Obviously, Fox is making a huge bet on it. And so you would think that, and Jamie Horowitz is talking about, you know, kind of replicating or attempting to replicate the Fox News model. So he's also somewhat replicating his own model at ESPN.
Right.
And look, it definitely has worked in pockets in TV, so I don't think it's going away. But the question is, how much are people going to pay for it? You know, in terms of saying when I say who's going to pay for it, I mean the executives. How much are these companies going to pay for it?
Right.
So I think, you know, that's to be determined. We'll see. I mean, are we living in an era where the entire industry is changing and opinion talk is going to be all the rage for the next 5 or 10 or 15 years, or is this a gigantic bubble? I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. As far as the second question about salaries, I would say because the people that are fronting these shows are much more the face of the show. Like if you look at a SportsCenter, for example, it's really largely been about sports, not the talent. Yes, you've had obviously The Big Show and, you know, Chris Berman in his heyday, Dan and Keith, but overall it's been about the show. But when you put on a His and Hers or you put on, you know, Colin Cowherd, it's all about the individual. So I think that you really can't say it's anything but the right combination or individual you have out there. And so I think those salaries are significantly higher. They've been, you know, the low end is like $250,000, $300,000, and the high end is, you know, middle high end, it could be $600,000. Plus, I mean, we're talking about like for middle level people,
right? So then what's interesting, I guess, is that the numbers of people who are going to sort of front that and get that money are small. But if you're one of those people, and obviously at the high end of the this is my word, bloviating scale, you're getting into the Bayless level where somebody like Jamie Horowitz is going to offer you $5 million a year plus a signing bonus. But that's the truest outlier, I would think, Steve. Right? That those salaries are not going to happen for very, very few people, except a Bayless or someone like that.
Yeah, Stephen A. It's been reported
right.
that he's making close to that.
Right.
I mean, Colin, what he's been reported
same, yeah, same structure.
I mean, so you know that those are the people that have become brands on their own. But then you have that whole, you know, next level. Are these guys really there yet? You know, you know all the names as well.
Yeah. Well, here's a question that fascinates me, and I know it's not an easy one, and it doesn't. I don't think it really hits your agency as much as other agencies. But can you represent someone whose content you don't particularly like or respect? Are you content agnostic to the point where if somebody has a political orthodoxy or somebody has a sports orthodoxy where you are like, I can't stand this thinking, can you still represent them as an agent? And do you want to represent them as an agent?
It's a great question. It depends. I think if you have somebody that, you know, you respect as a person and you respect where they come out with their opinions. I mean, I'll give you an example of a guy we do represent that's very controversial is Clay Travis. You know, he writes a lot of things that people disagree with. Sometimes I disagree with them, but I think he comes to it from an earnest place. I think he's a really smart guy, and I think he writes extremely well, and I think he adds a lot to the dialogue. I'm a huge believer in the First Amendment, as I said earlier, and I'm a big believer. I think we need more and more of a marketplace of ideas. So long as it's civilized and people aren't ready to kill each other, which, you know, hopefully we have more of, then I think there's room for all of it. I happen to represent a guy at Fox News who, believe it or not, is very liberal. I don't want to say his name because obviously, you know, there's a lot of controversy there, but, you know, I have people from all different stars and stripes, and I think there has to be room for that. As long as you respect the individual, I don't want to represent someone who I don't respect, even if they agree with every single thing I think politically or sports-wise.
I respect that answer. People know my sort of history with Clay Travis. I don't think either of us like each other professionally by any means, but I respect that answer. I think that's an honest answer, and there's no doubt Travis is a bright guy who's built the business. I would never say otherwise. In terms of this is very nuts and bolts, but I think people really can benefit from this. In terms of the negotiating parts of a contract, can you sort of just take us through what happens? A talent office or an executive at ESPN has an idea for a salary number, has an idea for dates, has an idea for what they want your client to do. So then what's next for you? Is it a back and forth on the specific language of the contract? Take us through like what a kind of a general negotiation might be and how long it might be.
Well, they're all different. You know, we had a contract a few years ago with an ESPN talent that started off as a 3-year contract and ended up as a 9-year contract.
Wow.
You know, you really try to do a lot of prep work before there's a negotiation. You don't want to be starting a negotiation when that talent office executive calls. You want to be prepared in terms of A, finding out what the marketplace is, both for that individual and what his leverage might be. That's first. Then secondly, you want to find out what the general, you know, understanding of the marketplace is for that type of an individual, irrespective of his leverage. You want to find out what the internal comps are inside the company that he's working for. So there's all that prep work that goes into that. And then you want to also try to find out, you know, what the company thinks of the guy. And sometimes they're going to be telegraphing and sometimes they won't tell you exactly what they think of the guy. They may undermine, you know, your client's value for their own purposes. And you can kind of get beyond that if you know exactly what they're thinking. I mean, look, we've been doing this for so long. And a lot of times at this point, Richard, we're dealing with people on the other side of the table that are friends. And it becomes, obviously, it's a negotiation. You have a fiduciary obligation to your client. And you can do the best for that individual. And the other side understands that, and they're doing the same thing for theirs. But at the same time, you're also their partner. I mean, we look at this business slightly differently, I think, than other agencies, maybe not, in that we try to look at ourselves as a supplier, if you will. So when we put a new talent into ESPN, it's almost like a building construction guy is buying concrete. Like if that concrete is going to leak or crack after 5 years, you're never going to go back to that concrete person again, as opposed to if the concrete lasts for 100 years, hey, I want to, what more concrete do you have? So we spend a lot of time learning about our clients before we even sign them, putting them through a writing sample, character references, and we make every single person come to New York, even if they can't afford it, we'll fly them in and meet them before we deal with them. So when you're dealing with that person on the other side of the table, you hope there's a lot of equity built up in the type of individual you're talking about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. What happens, Steve, when you have clients competing for the same job? How do you guys handle that?
Well, if it happens, which is rare for us, you disclose that to the client and you say, look, you know, there's a situation here where someone's looking for X and we have two or three people, but it's very rare. I mean, look, we only represent 150 people in the entire agency. And of those 150, we have a news division and a sports division. And so probably 75 of our clients are news and 75 are sports. And of those 75 that are sports, you know, 30 of them or 20 of them are play-by-play guys. And of those 20 play-by-play guys, 5 are working for professional teams. And some of them, like I said earlier, in long-term contracts. So we could have a situation where very often the opposite is true, where executive calls up and says, hey, we need X and we don't have X and we will never sign X just to have someone to pitch. So we often have the alternative to, you know, we try to, you know, as a selling point, say we're not going to have internal competition for you. And often we take that to an extreme, to our own detriment.
And as you mentioned, you have a news division. One of your clients, as I mentioned at the top, is Clarissa Ward of now CNN, who I think I might argue is your best client. I'm a huge, huge admirer of her work. Total news chops, integrity. So let's try not to lose her, Steve. That's an excellent client, in my opinion.
She's been with me since day one of her career, and she speaks 8 languages. And
exactly.
She's certainly our bravest client. I'll give her that. I also think she's a little crazy, which I tell her too, to be safe.
You
we
gotta,
need her to stay alive.
Yeah, you got to be a correspondent, a foreign correspondent at her level. You know, you sort of need a little bit of crazy, interestingly enough. All right, a couple more here for you. Again, this. I imagine this answer would be different if I was talking to a CAA agent, but how do you sort of define the world of grabbing the highest dollar figure from the places you're negotiating with, which gets you more money, versus balancing a long-term relationship with those networks? Because ultimately, you're going to have to keep going back to that networks for other clients, but you have individual clients who are like, hey, this is what I need. So how do you balance that? You need a long-term relationship with the ESPNs and the Foxes, but you have individual clients who want the most amount of money at that moment.
Well, first of all, I mean, these companies are making a lot of money. So we don't need to be holding any benefits for them, you know, because we got them in a negotiation and got, you know, extra, more money than they wanted to pay. That's first of all. Secondly, those situations where you're going to get more money than they want to pay you, it's almost invariably a case where you have a lot of leverage in the marketplace. And like I said, I mean, look, we've had relationships, you know, I've known Al Jaffe. I had dinner with him a few weeks ago. He's a long-term ESPN executive. He's retired now. I mean, we had, you know, 100 negotiations. And so you going back to them over and over again, I got to know him and his wife. He got to know my wife. I mean, these are relationships that go very deep. And if you have, you know, sometimes you have a fight with somebody, you get past it because there's a deep reservoir of a relationship to tap into. And they understand you're doing your job. If you don't fight your hardest for the client and get every last nickel off the table or close to every last nickel, you're going to lose them. And these guys know that, and they're not going to, you know, spite you and say, I'm not going to give you what I know you can get because it's going to hurt me. And it's just, it's a good natured aspect of the good fight, if you will.
Steve, who are the sports media executives at companies that you have to have a relationship with and that you do have a relationship with and that you need to cultivate it? I don't know if it's, you're talking about at the Skipper level, John Skipper, president of ESPN, or it goes lower into the talent offices, but you're, feel free to name a couple of names of people that are just key people in your life, given what you do.
I mean, John Skipper has become a good relationship. I have a lot of respect for him. John Wildhack, Rob Savinelli, Lori Orlando, now at CBS, Sam Flood, Mark Lazarus. I mean, I've known Mark Lazarus for almost 25 years now. You know, Eric Shanks, Jacob Ullman, Jamie Horowitz. I mean, these are all the people you deal with on a regular basis. David Burson, Sean McManus, you know, Ross Molloy, Ben Stauber. I mean, and I'm not a believer, like, sometimes you can get more done with a Ben Stauber or a Ross Molloy than you can with a Sean McManus. Not because Sean doesn't have more power, but because Ben and Ross are focused on it, and that's what they do all the time, where Sean's got to worry about securing, you know, rights deals for Augusta or what have you. And I'm not someone who says, oh, unless I'm dealing with the highest guy, I'm going to be able to get this deal done. That has not been my experience at all.
We should mention, you know, Ross Molloy is in the CBS talent office. I think he's a vice president of talent. Who is the other gentleman you just mentioned before?
Ben Stauber, who works with Ross,
in CBS,
former
right.
agent at IMG.
Right.
Rob Savinelli is now heading up the talent office at ESPN. Sam Flood is the executive producer of NBC Sports. Prince Al-Hare is a very close, I don't want to say friend, but I mean, yeah, he's a friend. I mean, yes, do I do 10 negotiations a year with him? Of course. But why can't, I mean, if he trusts me and I trust him and we are able to do deals together and the clients are happy and it's a good paradigm for their career, then I see nothing wrong with having a friendship with people that are on the other side of the table. I think there's a mutual respect there as well.
All right, here are my I'm sorry, Steve, go ahead.
I had a really tough negotiation with Sam Flood about 5 years ago. I mean, it was really hard. And he's not an easy guy at times. He's a very tough negotiator. But you know what? I thought, okay, this guy's going to be mad at me. And then a few weeks later, he recommended a new client to me. So I thought, okay, you know, maybe he respects that. But you just got to do it in what you know is right, you know? That's the only thing that can guide you.
What made it tough without mentioning the client?
I'm sorry?
What made that negotiation tough?
What made it tough is that he actually wanted to let go of this particular client. He wanted to not renew him on his contract. And to be frank, I begged him to give the guy one last chance, and he did. And I thought that showed a lot of character on his part.
Interesting. Here are my final two for you, Steve, and this has been really interesting. I'm glad I chose you as one of the people. I think it's going to be pretty compelling for the audience. In this business, Steve, and again, crossing over because you represent digitally based people, you represent television based people. How different is the salary structure for women versus men? And is there a gender wage gap?
There absolutely is a gender wage gap, and it's vastly different. Now, I'm not going to tell you that Hannah Storm, apples to apples, is making less money than her equal colleague at ESPN. Hannah's not a client of mine. I don't know. I think, you know, in that scenario, it's pretty equal. But, you know, I think most of the jobs still to this day, with some exception, are the lower end jobs for women. So they're going to be paid equal to the lower end that the men are paid. So in that respect, it's fair, but they're still being sort of segued into, you know, quote unquote, the back of the bus of the sports television, you know, world. Will that change? Yes, I think it will, but it's also going to require women to take those kinds of jobs.
All right. Don't you think that's most of the people that you mentioned before in terms of the talent executive side that you deal with? I don't think you mentioned a woman's name except Lori Orlando. They're all men, correct?
Yeah, it's a good point. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but you're right. They're all men. I mean, there's some new people in the ESPN talent office that are female. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there's Elise Noonan, who is in the NBC talent office, is relatively new and young, very good. So there are some people we deal with, but you're right. Most of them are women. Although in news, ironically, almost every talent executive is a woman.
Interesting. All right. Here's the final one, Steve. You're someone, and your agency is a place that studies obviously the trends going on at all these places, particularly in sports broadcasting. You have seen Fox dropping people who are on air. Obviously, they've added some opinion people, but as a general rule, people took buyouts there. There's even some names that we don't know yet that on-air people who are not going to be at FS1 very, very shortly. Obviously, at ESPN, we have seen a ton of people leave, not just high-profile names, but lower-profile on-air people not being re-signed. I've heard that there's a possibility that we may see as the year gets to the end, contracts not being re-upped in an attempt to cost save. What are you seeing in terms of the – we'll just keep it at sports broadcasting to end this. What are you seeing in terms of trending, in terms of our – is there going to be a large reshuffling in terms of money? Because there's no doubt that some of these companies have reduced their salary structure, or at least reduced salaries in the last 12 months.
No, I think you're going to see more of that. At the end of the day, I think that people that are perceived as commodities are very vulnerable. Anyone that is replaceable, like I said earlier, if you're making $300,000 a year and there's a guy in Topeka who will take your job for $150,000, you're very vulnerable. But if you are someone who has some kind of texture or some kind of difference, whether it's a big social media profile or you have something that helps you break through, like if you wear crazy jackets and you're known for that, like you're Craig Sager, or if you're Tim Russert and you had the whiteboard and you had some kind of defining quality that is not replaceable by someone else, you know, that's been the difference maker. Chris Berman in his heyday had a tremendous, you know, run with nicknames and the Swami. You know, if you're not a brand, and I hate that word, but if you're not a brand or you're not known as something outside of, you know, the typical sportscaster, I think you're vulnerable.
Steve Herz is the president and founder of If Management. Their website, I believe, is ifmanagement.com. But Steve, you went 40 minutes without a drink of water. I appreciate that. Their website is ifmanagement.com. You can find them on the web. You'll see their clients. And you know, if you're interested in the business, he's an excellent guy to get in touch with and just bounce some things off of. I've always found that in the 5 to 10 years now that I've known him.
Can I ask one quick thing?
Yeah.
I think the thing that I'm most proud of as an agent is just the continuity we've had at IF. And also, I just wanted people to know this company is not about me. It's, you know, Gideon has been an integral part of this company for 16 years. Jeff and Josh and Gideon all started here as interns. They've never had another job. And I just wanted, honestly, just to give them a plug, because I think people, unfortunately, think it's about me, and the company is not about me. And I'm not saying that to be humble. It's just that these guys are really the ones doing all the hard work in the trenches.
Steve, listen, I really appreciate your time today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and I imagine our paths will cross down the road again.
All right, thank you, Richard. Appreciate you having me.
All right, as promised, as part of our agent podcast roundtable, we bring in Matt Kramer of CAA, I imagine, because everybody seemingly from CAA is working out of a beautiful Los Angeles office. That is where Matt Kramer is. Matt, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me. Good morning from Los Angeles.
Man, how many of your colleagues and bosses you think will be listening to this podcast? What's the over-under for you?
That's a good question. I think we're always paying attention to this podcast. It's a must-listen, but I couldn't give you a definitive answer on how many are actually listening. I think enough people listen to me in this company during the day that they don't need to hear me necessarily on the podcast.
And what would you say if Las Vegas odds makers were putting out odds on the potential for you to be fired after this podcast? What would you what would you make that, a 7-to-1, a 5-to-1, or a little lower?
I'm not in the odds-making business. I'm not in the odds-making business. I'll do everything I can to keep my job.
Look at you being diplomatic. I like that. All right. This this podcast will be very inside baseball, but I think you guys are going to find it interesting because broadcast agents, sports media agents, don't often talk a lot in mainstream. They'll talk to some industry publications, but it's not always the case with the quote-unquote mainstream of us who cover sports media. So first off, Matt, we'll take a very basic question, and that is, how do you find your clients?
You know, if we do great work for our existing clients, we find that more often than not, they may have a conversation with a colleague or a friend, and they might refer us to somebody new. There's no manual, there's no playbook where an agent follows where they say, okay, this is exactly where I'm going to go to find a new client this year. You know, people in this business talk. If we're doing really great work for the clients that we represent, and you know, we're trying to do that every day, then we're fortunate to sometimes get put in front of other talent who might be looking for that same type of service. We're not really in the business of cold calling. You're not in the advertising business. There's no formula. It's a referral business, and I think that's probably the way in which we find most of our clients.
Matt, if I'm someone interested in CAA and Matt Kramer representing me, how much are you pitching me on you, and how much should I be pitching you on me?
Look, it's a good question. I think when you're an agent and you're looking to identify talent, we're looking at somebody. If we're looking at somebody, we're saying to ourselves first, can we help that person in their core business? Do we think we can be effective for them to getting them to the level that they want to be at? You know, if someone is coming to us, pitching their services to us, hi, I'm, you know, Prospect X. I am a AAA play-by-play broadcaster, and I believe that next year I should be calling Monday Night Football. We're going to have an open and honest conversation with them that says, look, you might be extraordinarily talented, but we're not sure we can get you the Monday Night Football job next year. So I think there's an element of honesty that both sides have to have if you want to get into business with each other.
Matt, and again, you know, when we talk prior to this podcast, I'm certainly going to ask you about some salary stuff. I will do my best not to ask you about specific clients, I think sort of out of fairness. And the fact is that out of proprietary reasons, you're not going to give me specific answers to that. But as a general rule, what percentage of a client's contract, of a client's work, would an agent in your position take for your work?
10%.
10%. Is that, do you find that to be an industry standard, or depending on the agency, they may take more or less?
Yeah, no, that's an industry standard, 10% on the representation of that client.
Do you feel that you're worth 10%?
Certainly. I think without a doubt, the agent is, you know, the work is done, we like to say, not just during the contract negotiation, but most of the work is done after the contract has been negotiated in working to strategize with our clients and position our clients for whatever may happen to them next. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, what, I guess the best way I could describe it is, you know, when we're looking at working with a client, we're working with them not just on the transaction that we're doing for them right now, but we're working with them on a long-term strategy to position them to be in a place where they want to be, whether that's 5 years from now, 10 years from now, or 20 years from now. So without a doubt, it's not just about what we're able to do for them financially with their existing contract, but what we might be able to do for them long-term.
If you were talking to a 23-year-old woman or man who wants to make it in the sports business, who wants to make it in the sports media business today, presumably front-facing, on-air, or high-profile writer, what would you tell him or her right now, and why?
The first thing I would tell them to do is when they're having a conversation with potential representatives, I would tell them to make sure they understand not to enter into any sort of agreement with an agency in which that agency has the ability to sign that client and negotiate a deal on their behalf and then take commission on that client for the length of the time in which that talent is at a network. It's really disgusting what some of our what some other agents are doing, in that what they're doing is they're identifying, they're having a conversation with a network executive. They're going back to, they're finding out who that network executive wants. They're going to that 23-year-old. They're saying to that 23-year-old, sign with me, I'll deliver you to this network. Before I deliver you to that network, I want you to sign this representation agreement. The representation agreement says that I will take 10% of commission for the length that you are at that network, whether I'm your agent or not.
Wow.
And what happens is these clients and these young broadcasters are stuck in these representation agreements with these agencies that do very, very little work for them, and they're stuck for the next 10, 15, 20 years paying commission to agents that have done nothing except basically pull a fast one on them. You know, so I think that what I would advise, or what we would advise to a young broadcaster, is you want to work with somebody who is not trying to take advantage of you. That's a really, really important thing.
Can I get to ESPN, Fox Sports 1, NBC Sports Network, CBS Sports Network without an agent at a CAA or an IMG or an IF Management, et cetera?
You know, look, I think without a doubt, the networks are hiring the talent, right? The networks are out identifying talent and hiring that talent. No agency has the power to simply switch the light bulb on and convince a network they need to hire client A, B, or C. Without a doubt, though, if a client wants to be positioned in the best way moving forward, certainly having an agent at CAA would be incredibly beneficial.
Now, Matt, you say that, but there are shows on both ESPN and FS1 where every person on that show front-facing is a CAA client. So you cannot deny that your agency does not have significant influence, at least in terms of some of the decisions that are made.
Here's the thing, though. We don't have a say in who the network hires, right? In the television business, the network is king. You know, they buy who they want to buy. And for any agent to sit back and say, yeah, we have a ton of power, yeah, that's sort of chest pumping. We don't. It'd be great to have power to determine who a television executive hires, but this business is a client business. You know, the agent works for the client. And I think what we find is that network executives will return an agent or an agency's call because of the specific client that that agency represents. You know, a lot of agents forget that if you lose your clients, you lose that access to the network executive.
Right.
And at the end of the day, it's all about the clients.
How competitive is this business between agencies competing for talent?
Extremely competitive. And here's why. You know, in the last, 10, 15 years, you know, the one thing that's become DVR-proof is live sports, right? There's a reason why these sports television networks are paying a premium for the type of sports content that they're getting. And look, sometimes not even sports networks are the one paying a premium for that. So if a network is going to pay $1 billion for NBA or NFL or Major League Baseball, they're going to want the very best people and the very best talent to be calling those games or to be handling, you know, pregame, postgame, the opinionated content prior to the game. And because they're going to pay a premium for a talent, certainly it's a very competitive business, because we're all in the business of making our clients as much money as possible, and other people want to be in that business.
What kind of salary can a sports broadcaster make in a mid-major market? Let's say they're on the news channel there in a Louisville or a Cleveland or something like that.
You know, look, the local, you're talking like local affiliate television?
Yeah.
Local affiliate television has, you know, certainly changed its philosophy on compensating sports media personalities in the last, I would say, 10 or 15 years. It used to be that local sports was a clear avenue to the larger market, to the larger, you know, networks. But nowadays, what you're seeing is you're seeing so many different niche sports networks that so many of those sports networks need to hire talent. You know, and we use an example, Major League Baseball Network, SEC Network, Big Ten Network. So these guys are hiring 30, 40, 50 broadcasters that initially would have been working in the Louisvilles or would have been working in the San Diegos. So, you know, I think in local market TV, you're still seeing salaries under six figures for mid-market. But what you're seeing at the same time is the niche sports networks are paying, you know, pretty good money because they've got to put together a really, really solid product.
So if I'm working at the SEC Network, Pac-12 Network, Big Ten Network, I'm not Dave Revson, I'm not Brent Musburger, I'm not the faces of these networks, but I'm one of these play-by-play broadcasters, or I'm one of these studio personalities. You know, I was a former coach at one of these places, or I played football in the conference. What can I reasonably expect to make there?
It depends on the specific type of role that that broadcaster is going to do. So if somebody wants to work on what we call sort of an independent contractor or a freelance basis, and they're going to work 10 games, you know, they're going to call 10 football games, or they're going to call 25 basketball games, you might make sort of low four figures per game or mid four figures per game. If you're going to be working a full slate, you know, 200 days, you're going to be working all sorts of different programming for the network. Look, at the end of the day, if the network believes that this personality is really important to the network from not just the content side, but even potentially from a sales side, from a marketing side, you can easily get into the high six figures, seven figures, you name it.
Matt, as a general rule, and again, there are so many different people who work in an ESPN and an FS1, as a general rule, If I'm just hired by ESPN from some regional place, you know, Chicago, Comcast, or, you know, Boston, or wherever I am, and I'm going to ESPN, and I'm joining them as a either like a reporter or someone who's going to do SportsCenter on you know, the ESPN News as sort of a farm system to eventually get to big ESPN. What kind of salary number might I be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, you're probably looking at a low six-figure salary. And I think that's an interesting point, low six figures
meaning 200,000, 400,000, what's low six? So just we're specific to the audience.
Yeah, 200,000, okay. You know, in that range, right? I think the interesting thing, though, and you sort of note that, right, which is if I'm somebody who just wants to be in the farm system, what can I make, right? In today's marketplace, one of the things we talk about here all the time in our group, which is a group of really, really, I have a group of colleagues who are really excellent in their space, and that's in the sports media space. We're talking to them about if you're going to enter ESPN at the sort of generic, what we call ESPN news level, we want to work with our clients and strategize with our clients about where we think ESPN may be going with that type of personality. But more importantly, is that personality a potentially an expert in one of the spaces in which ESPN has a large investment sports-wise? Does that person have a deep background coming from their previous place in NFL? Does that person have a background in NBA? Does that person have a background in any of the sports in which ESPN has a large investment? Because if that's the case, then we'll work to help open up doors for them inside the building and try to potentially down the road move them into one of those sort of sports-specific roles in which they can really thrive.
Do women, as a general rule, make less than men in this business?
I don't know if that's the case. I think the truth of the matter is the network hires a specific person and pays a specific person for the role that they believe that person is best suited for. There are women at ESPN who are making millions of dollars a year. There's men who are making millions of dollars a year. I don't think... You know, I'm not privy to all, obviously, of the financials behind what people are making, but I think that we've never been in a situation where we've ever felt that a woman is necessarily making less than their male counterpart, right? You look at Hannah Storm, you look at Michelle Beadle, you look at Sage Steele, all of those women make a really, really nice living. there's a reason they make a nice living. They're excellent at what they do, but I don't necessarily think that when we're in contract negotiations with an executive, we're thinking to ourselves, okay, this executive is thinking that's a female, I'll pay that person 25% less.
Right. I guess my question would be, does a Shelly Smith make the same as a Sal Palantonio? That would be of interest to me because they're sort of similar jobs. And then is the woman being paid the same as the man for essentially kind of the same? Obviously one covers the NFL, one does more enterprise, but you understand my question.
I mean, look, here's probably the best way to answer this. They probably didn't make the same before. Right? I think if you look at what the landscape may have been like 10, 20, 25 years ago, I think it would be probably much clearer that a male may have made more than a female. But when you look and you have conversations with the talent executives across all of the different networks, we're never having conversations about the gender of that personality.
You don't want there to be a bubble bursting on any kind of large talent deals. But when I talk to people at all the different networks, and there are certainly still people getting gigantic network deals. Your agency obviously negotiated the Skip Bayless deal. I admire you guys for
And that's why I'm here in Los Angeles, not for the Skip Bayless situation, but obviously for the first tapings this week of Speak for Yourself.
Right. When will you be signing Lord Voldemort? Now that you've signed Bayless, I mean, you might as well get one of the great movie villains of all time to your stable. But no, in all seriousness, the it's interesting to me. Do you think that the talent deals will continue to go up as they have over the last 10 to 15 years, or because of cost cutting, which we've seen at both ESPN and FS1 in particular, will we see a large shift in the salary structure of talent heading forward?
No, see, what we're seeing is a shift not necessarily in salaries moving forward. We're seeing a shift in the amount of different buyers of a certain piece of content or a certain person, right? When you look at HBO getting into, you know, the sports space with certain personalities, you look at a place like Yahoo, which did not really have a sports presence a decade ago, you know, paying a premium for talent who is delivering specific content that a specific audience wants. You know, the bubble isn't bursting. The bubble's just moving in a different direction, and different entities want to be in the sports business because the sports business is the one thing that you and I and Beth and everybody, we're not DVRing. We have to watch the games because we have to watch the game. We have to watch a game live. I'm a Michigan grad. I know you're a Michigan guy. We're not going to watch the game on Saturday, September 17th between Michigan and Colorado. We're not going to watch that on Wednesday, September 20th and not know what happened. We have to watch live sports, and we have to watch live sports live. And because of that, there's always going to be a premium put on live sports content.
Do you have any other Yahoo clients other than Woj and Chris Mannix?
Say that again?
Do you have any other Yahoo clients other than Woj and Chris Mannix?
Pat Forty is a client from the football side. Oh. Kevin Ioli, who covers boxing at Yahoo, is a client.
Well, yeah, look at Lee. Budding Yahoo
guys are Yahoo.
Budding Yahoo dynasty, Matt Kramer. It's interesting. All right, you work for CAA, and there are hundreds of people. I think I'm right about this. Probably placed at ESPN and Fox and HBO, and at other places that work, or that I should say that are represented by your company. What happens when you are submitting multiple clients for the same job? And if it's not Matt Kramer doing it, what happens when Matt Kramer has a client and a Nick Kahn, let's say, has a client who are both going for the same job?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of transitions back to the conversation we were having earlier. At the end of the day, the talent executive is making the hire, right? The talent executive, the network determines, you know, who they want. The best analogy is probably if you're a talent executive and you're looking to purchase a 50-inch Samsung TV. If you come in and look to purchase a 50-inch Samsung TV and myself or any of our colleagues are trying to sell you the 35-inch Zenith and the 37-inch Zenith or the 61-inch Zenith, you know, at the end of the day, you've walked into that electronics store and you knew you wanted to buy that certain television first. So it's never really a situation where we're in competition with each other. We are collaborating. We're always discussing what opportunities are out there. We're always sharing information about what we're hearing, but we're not competing against each other.
One of my colleagues, Maggie Gray, who hosts our SI Now show, you know, I think has the potential, or not even potential. I think she easily could work in an ESPN or a place like that. She asked me. She forwarded a couple of really, I thought, interesting questions for me that I wanted to ask you. And she's someone who's dealt with agents over the years. How? This is sort of a multi-part question. How honest are you when your clients get rejected from jobs because of age?
Because of age?
Yeah.
100% honest. We're honest with them based on whether they get rejected for any reason. There is no reason an agent wouldn't be honest with their client. We're not magicians, right? We're not people who can simply snap our fingers and make something happen. If a agent, here's the probably the better way to discuss that. If an agent knows that that person wasn't hired because of age, I actually think that is important to be able to find out and discuss with that talent and say, hey, listen, you want to go to a place and you want to work at a place where you believe that the network supports you. You don't want to be put in a position, and you never force your client to go to to take a job where you don't believe that the network is totally, totally, totally behind you and ready to go.
How often have you had clients, if ever, been rejected because of the following: looks, gender, race and ethnicity, or something other than ability?
I don't know if any agent can truly answer that question, right? I think that executives are very, very smart people. They're very opinionated people as well. This is an incredibly subjective business. Unlike maybe athletics, where it's very clear that a quarterback who throws 35 touchdowns is better than a quarterback who throws 5, the sports media landscape is very subjective, and different networks may think completely differently about the same person. So, you know, the world is evolving, thankfully. There's no question about that. You know, at the end of the day, if a network doesn't make a decision on a specific talent, it could be for any number of those reasons. And they may not always share that with you openly and honestly. We're trying to find that. We're trying to find out why. We want to share bad news with our clients just as fast as we want to share good news. But to sit here and say 50% of the time a client doesn't get hired because of looks, I don't know if that's the case.
Do you believe it happens with gender or race and ethnicity, that somebody doesn't get a job because they're a woman, because they're black, because they're whatever?
Have it happened? No question. No question. Could we specifically say, hey, Richard, right now, you and I can agree that this person didn't get that job because of gender or ethnicity? I don't know if I could specifically say that, but there's no question it's happened before.
You mentioned that you want to be as transparent as possible with your clients. You want to be honest with them. Have you ever suggested to a client to get plastic surgery?
No, never.
What about losing weight?
Never.
Changing something about their appearance?
No.
Okay, that's interesting. Do you think, but, you know, having, again, talked to people in the field, I know that there are agents who have told their clients that.
The thing you have a conversation with, and I don't think anyone would ever deny this, is we may have a conversation with them about maybe their clothing, but that may be literally, and that's actually probably the other way. These guys are extremely reputable journalists. They're providing great content. We don't want anything to distract the audience from that. We're not talent executives. We're not, we're consumers of this product just like you or anybody else is, but under no circumstances have I ever said, you need to go get plastic surgery.
Why do you think there are not a lot of women agents in your space? There have been some, but they're not a ton.
You know, I came from an agency where there were three of us there were three agents that were representing media talent, and two of them were women. So it's probably not the best question for me. I don't think there has anything to do with, I don't think this business has anything to do with gender. I really don't.
How do you respond to what is, I think you know this tag has existed in some circles, of CAA poaching talent from smaller agencies?
You know, look, we discussed this before, I think, which is the concept of if you do great work for your existing clients, those clients may or may not have conversations with other talent that they work with. The concept of us going out and poaching is a narrative that, you know, people at other agencies may use, and it's really a little bit more of the philosophy that Jeff Bezos said when he talked on 60 Minutes a couple of years ago, that, you know, complaining is not really a strategy. You have to do the work. You have to go out and make things happen for your clients. You know, if you got to earn your keep. Talent wants sort of honest, strong, effective agents. And there's no different, it's no different than sort of the business of directors, actors, actresses. You know, we don't believe anyone can steal your spouse. You know, we just don't. If a person wants to make a move, they make a move.
Would you take on Emily Austin as a client right now?
Emily Austin, the woman who last week had the barstool situation?
Correct.
You know, that's a good question. I think the real question is, we would have to monitor Emily, what Emily has done, and I'd have to go back over the last couple of days and see what kind of things she has done publicly to address the issue, and whether or not we feel like she's addressed the issue in a space where she really believes that long term, you know, this is a situation where it was a one-time issue. Right now, I would probably say no.
Let me ask you a question about, you know, obviously the clients you work with, there's a reason you are working with them. You obviously believe in them and you like them. But philosophically, Matt, could you represent somebody whose content you didn't respect?
Content we didn't respect. What do you mean by that?
Someone who either on television or in their writing writes things or says things that just you fundamentally disagree with as a human being.
You mutual friend Jamie Horowitz. Right?
I'm not familiar with that name. I'm not familiar with that name.
Mutual friend Jamie Horowitz. Right. You know, I heard from clients who've interacted with him that there's a line that he uses, which is, you know, to be great on television, you have to have three things, right? You have to have ratings, you have to have relevancy, and you have to generate revenue. You know, if you can have all three of those, great. And, you know, whether or not we're not in the business of ever dictating the type of content that our clients produce. We're in the business of strategizing with them a long-term plan to put them in the best position to be successful.
Don't you think you're sort of escaping a little bit of the idea that you should want to be in business with people whose content you respect?
No, I mean, when you think about it,
that's an
probably agree that Outside the Lines is a terrific, terrific, terrific show.
Right, definitely.
I think you and I probably agree that we wished Outside the Lines, and I trust me, this is nothing against ESPN programmers or anything like that. I love the content of Outside the Lines. I wish Outside the Lines was one of the highest rated shows in the history of ESPN. Then every network would want to run all sorts of Outside the Lines like shows,
right?
And we could all be representing, you know, the very best journalists in their space.
Yeah, I agree. But the reality is there are many things on ESPN, including shoulder programming, that draw more. I would never disagree that. And by the way, I do appreciate you bringing up Jamie Horowitz. We should mention, for the audience that doesn't know, he's Fox Nationals president. He's running FS1. And given that I would say CAA is co-running it with him, I'm glad that Matt has brought him up for this podcast.
It would be great to say we were co-running any network. Trust me.
I'm almost being polite. I actually think you are running FS1. I actually would like to eliminate the co in that.
We wish. Look, I mean, I think when you look at what they're doing at Fox Sports One,
right, the official network of CAA. Go ahead.
You look at when you look at what they're doing. And I, like I said, I was here a couple days ago, and I've been here the last couple days, seeing the guys for Speak for Yourself. You know, they are building a strategy out of programming in the middle of the day that showcases, you know, opinion-based programming that time and time again on some of the other sports networks has sort of proven to be ratings high. And they're in, you know, they have a specific strategy. They still put on excellent, excellent, excellent live events. They put on, they have done football amazingly well since 1994.
Definitely.
You know, the guys like Jacob Ullman and John Entz have produced football, baseball, and NASCAR tremendously for two decades. And as they, you know, they're shifting their daytime programming with the way the audience is consuming, we're all sort of consuming our opinion-based programming and our news and highlights-based programming.
I like that you name-dropped your colleagues at Fox. Wait a minute. You're working for CAA. I'm sorry about that.
Wish.
I'll ask you one question about, you mentioned opinion-based, and obviously Fox now has a strategy to have provocateurs, to have opinion-based people. It's very clear that that if you want to work for that network, you have to have a lot of takes. You have clients that I think have pushed massively in that direction. Do you see that as a general sort of, it's interesting to me, as a general rule, do you think the industry, and let's sort of take broadcasting as a point, do you need to be more provocative and more opinion-based, especially if you're in your 20s, to land on television as you head forward, or do you think you can be middle of the road, more reporting based? Because it strikes me, at least we are in a moment, and obviously, Matt, everything, things are cyclical, but we're at a moment where I think there are a lot of people who are pushing opinion because I think they see that it is a path to getting a television job.
You know, we've had conversations here in our group at CAA about the concept that 5 or 6 years ago, the sort of sports columnist was dead, right? The breaking news reporter who came from a print journalism background or who was in a new media place was really the guy who he or she were really the ones who were thrust up into the spotlight at all of the television networks. It was about breaking news. The ESPN did an amazing job in the last decade of turning themselves truly into a 24/7 news network, as well as putting on, you know, live events. In the last couple of years, we used to talk about how the columnist was dead, how the columnist was not relevant anymore. And the truth is, what we're finding out, I think, from the agency side, is that the columnist is maybe dead in the print space, but has transitioned totally into the television space. If you look at the background of a lot of the people who are on daytime programming, a lot of them do come from the print world, come from columnist backgrounds, or come from the newspaper background. So if you say, hey, do you try to tell your person that they have to have a take, look, the truth is many of them had takes before. They just had them on different platforms.
That's interesting. And I tend to think at the moment, in this moment in time, I see there's a bit of a sports culture war between the opinionists and those who are not opinionists. But I think I find this topic just fascinating because I think to talk to people like you who ultimately deal with the people at networks who hire, I think you are correct that if you want to fashion a career on television, I think that at the moment is what the networks are looking for. Obviously, this is a very different discussion if you want to be a digital-based person. I think there will always be room for you if you're a narrative storyteller, if you're a reporter. But specific to television, at least in terms of the big boys like ESPN and NBC Network and FS1, very rare, I think, are we going to see a hire who is not bringing some kind of opinion and at times has to be polarizing.
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, there's really, really, really good sports journalism and really, really good sports media personalities across all sorts of different sports networks. You know, Paul Feinbaum has amazing takes, and he's on SEC Network.
Right. We'll mention a CAA client of MLB. Nicholas Kahn.
Look, Chris Russo, who's not a client of CAA, has an opinion-based take show on MLB Network in the middle of the day. You know, this, you know, NBA TV runs opinion-based programming, you know, later in the evening, earlier in the evening. You know, what is sports, right? Sports is the concept that four, five, six of us can all sit on the couch, watch a game, and have a conversation about it.
Right.
And that's where I think the television networks have understood, you know, we consume our news and information differently, but we still consume our conversations the same way. And people like to, during the day, like to have conversations about what's either happening tonight or what happened last night.
Right.
I think that's where the networks have identified opportunities for them to really be successful.
I'll give you a couple more, Matt, and then we'll let you go. I mean, you've gone through all the FS1 talking points, so I appreciate that. It's nice of you. All right, let me ask you this. This was a question from someone I trust, and I think it's pretty interesting. Which sports media executives do you admire, and who do you believe has the pulse on what's next in the industry?
The question was, which sports media executives
right.
do I admire?
Yeah, people that you deal with, obviously. And again, if it's like you don't want to sort of name one person because you want to alienate everybody, but when you are looking around, whether it's a John Skipper type or a Mark Lazarus
sure.
type or somebody at Yahoo, who do you feel like these guys have a real sense of where sports media is heading next?
You know, John Skipper, certainly I have admiration for Rob McGlary at MLB Network, Scooter Vertino at NBA TV, certainly Jamie and what Jamie is doing in their space at Fox Sports One. Younger executives like Peter Nelson at HBO Sports. There's a lot of really, you know, Mark Lazarus, who I worked with previously at the agency I was at before he went to NBC Sports, have known Mark for a while and have had great respect and admiration for him. And then really people in the talent office at certain networks as well, who you feel like you can always have honest conversations with. Rob Savinelli at ESPN, you know, to name somebody there. If you feel like you can have an honest and open conversation with any sort of executive, then I think you have respect for them.
How do you define, Matt, the line between working for your clients, and ultimately every client wants to get the highest possible salary from the place that they're negotiating with, versus the balancing the long-term relationships that you need with talent offices and executives? That's like a fascinating part of the business to me. It's because, like, you know, if you're, let's say you or, you know, or Nick Kahn or someone is negotiating with your talent office, or even if it gets to the highest levels with John Skipper, you're going to have a lot of clients that are going to float through the ESPN ecosystem. So how do you know when to really push it for one client without alienating ESPN and ESPN's executives thinking this is an asshole, I don't want to deal with this agent again? That to me is like a fascinating thing that I think you guys have to juggle with all the time.
Sure. The best agents are the most honest brokers. I've been fortunate for the last 9 months. I've watched Nick Kahn, you know,
That's the fourth reference for Nick Kahn. So we're two away from six.
I've watched executives at CAA Sports, Howie Neuchow, Mike Levine, even Jimmy Sexton in football, Todd France in football, and I've watched them interact with their clients and either the general managers or the television executives. And you try to take a little bit from everyone. The truth is, like I said earlier, you've got to be an honest broker, and it means both things. You've got to be honest, and you've got to be a broker, and you're always having conversations with your clients that talk about, hey, we're trying to find a win-win situation here with the network. We want you to be really, really happy. We want you to be at a place that you feel you've got the best growth potential, but you also want to feel like the network believes that too. And we always say this, there are agents out there who believe that if you push hard and if you push harder and harder and harder, you're going to get that extra $5,000, that extra $100,000. But it's never going to work 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. The television executives are smart guys and girls. They always remember when an agent was truthful with them, and they always remember when an agent really tried to win an argument or win a negotiation, and it never paid off.
What's it like to be fired by a client?
What's it like to be followed?
Fired by a client, let go by
fired.
A client. Yeah.
Happens all the time. I mean, at the end of the day, there's no such thing as an agent who's never been fired by a client. You know, it It's not something where you sit back and you want to spend the next 6 months stewing over. You recognize or you identify, why did this situation not work? And you try to make an adjustment moving forward with everyone else that you have.
What do you think? What do you think the prospect is? This is interesting to me. I'll just sort of put it on Sports Illustrated. What should writers do at Sports Illustrated to try to market themselves better in the marketplace? You have a couple in Chris Mannix, obviously, who bumped, who went to Yahoo and also has television and radio on his resume, mm-hmm. got a much higher profile. Obviously, you know, and I think Adrian Wojnarowski is talking about this publicly. I mean, there was a time where he thought he was happy to be a $50,000 a year sports writer. He hooked up with you, and you know, his I don't expect you to talk about specifics. I'll say it, but it's $1 million type of sports writer now. So there are a lot of writers who listen to this podcast. What would you advise writers at a place to try to increase their standing financially in what is a tough business?
You know, Adrian, and obviously just to speak, you know, briefly regarding the Adrian situation, or Adrian has a longtime client and a longtime friend, I think. The truth of the matter is Adrian works harder than anyone that I met, or had worked harder than anyone that I met 5, 6, 7 years
right.
ago.
Great,
and still
great,
to this day has
great
an
reporter.
Amazing work ethic.
Absolutely.
Chris Mannix, same way. We realize with Chris Mannix is he's hosting a radio show 5 days a week. He's flying across the country, you know, working with Adrian on the vertical and working to break news and working to have opinion-based content. But if you look at why Adrian Wojnarowski is as successful as he is, it's because he has a work ethic that no one else I've been fortunate enough to work with had when we first met, and currently and still currently has now. And that is not to say that all my other clients don't have great work ethics. Adrian is just a very special person in that space. And to Adrian's credit, most people who become bigger personalities, so to speak, immediately, you know, say, I want to be a TV star, or I want to be in movies, or I want to be in sitcoms. And what makes Adrian so unique and very special is he identified, and when we were working together on this, when we made the last deal, identified this, you know, something that he believed he would be really strong at, which is hosting a podcast. And the Vertical Podcast Network with him and JJ Redick, which was the first time I think a player had ever done a podcast during the season, and Mannix, it really fit Adrian and fit Chris much better than an agent trying to sort of force these guys into becoming television personalities. And it stayed on brand with who they were. So I think from an advice standpoint, for writers who are looking to be, you know, millionaires, you've got to put the work in, you've got to work really hard, and you've got to stick to your brand, and you've got to stick to who you are. If you try to force something, it's never going to work.
All right, listen, you have praised so many of your clients at this point, Matt, that my head is spinning. I cannot say anything nice about Chris Mannix, although you absolutely helped make the guy rich, and he made the right move. We miss
Chris
Mannix
did
here.
Himself. Chris,
right. Of course. Chris did it himself
really
as well.
Good on video. Chris is a really, really good radio personality, and he did it himself.
Let's not go crazy, Matt. The point is that you need an agency like CAA oftentimes to help you take the next big financial step. You know this. This is how the world works. You've been very much Kofi Annan, a diplomat on this podcast, but can you at least give me that honesty that you absolutely helped the Chris Mannix get to a certain level? Can you take credit for that, Matt?
I do. I think we're the best in the business, right. And I wouldn't say that if I didn't honestly believe that. Working with Nick Kahn, working with Evan Dick, working with Tom Young, working with Adam Hirsch, working with Matt Olson, these are all guys that I'm actually really lucky to work with every single day. We are constantly communicating with each other. We're constantly sharing information that we can then take back to our clients. There's a line that Nick has here at the agency, which is that every macro decision is based on 1,000 different micro decisions. We're working to put the pieces of a puzzle together every day to try to help our clients figure out where the next play may be for them. And so what's great about a place like this is there's so much collaboration, there's so much communication that you're always feeling like whenever you see a story and you hear that agents at other agencies are reacting to that story, the great thing about being at CAA is you may have heard that story before that story hit. and how we can then help our clients get there, that's the most important thing. There is no question that you want an agent and an agency that lives under the thought process that you've got to be proactive to be successful.
All right, Matt Kramer has just name-dropped more people, Bet, than the Page Six of the New York Post, so we're going to have to let him go at this point. All right, Matt Kramer is a agent for CAA, Creative Artists Agency, one of the biggest talent places in the world. He, as we mentioned at the top, the people we mentioned some of the people he represents, including Doris Burke, who we didn't get to talk to, who was awesome, Adrian Wojnarowski.
Wonderful.
And many others. Listen, Matt, it's not and I will say this to our other guest. You know, there's more downside than upside for you to do this podcast, but I think it's interesting for people to get a glimpse of this because the things that you do, as generally speaking, 99% of the public has no idea. So I appreciate you taking the time to come on the Sports Illustrated Media podcast, and I wish you success heading forward in your empire building.
I really appreciate you having me on. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for having this podcast, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, man.
All right, back in the studio with Bet Marston. We'll make this quick. My thanks to Steve Herz and Matt Kramer, obviously, first. Got some excellent podcasts coming up, including Rembert Brown of New York Magazine, out in a couple weeks, obviously out now. Brent Musburger, you know, of legendary sportscaster fame, and Eli Saslow, the brilliant narrative writer for The Washington Post. All right, Bet, I know you had a couple things, some observations about this podcast, so I'll go to you.
I mean, honestly, the part that shocked him the most was the part that he let off with when he said that he did say that he had told his clients to lose weight or to look better. And I kind of appreciated his honesty in that. Like, I feel like people try and skirt over it and say, oh, it's not, you know, all about the looks. But like, yeah, it's just kind of the way the world is now, and it sucks. But I like that he didn't sugarcoat it or anything. And then, you know, he kind of did defend himself and say, oh, like, well, it doesn't matter for me. Like, I can be a little bit overweight. But if my clients want to get the top job, then they need to do everything they possibly can. And that includes improving their voice, improving their looks, improving their weight, everything. And so, I don't know. I liked his honesty. I thought, what about you guys?
But isn't it? So do I. First of all, that by far and away was – I really appreciate him being honest. But we both work in a digital medium, digital/print, obviously. And these are generally not things that we have to deal with all the time. I mean,
no.
You know, both of us can be on camera occasionally and stuff, but it does make you think about sort of what that business is and the things that are important in that business. And he's being honest. It is a visual business, but man, I mean, I'm not even trying to be a Pollyanna. It just sucks that, like, you could have the greatest content person, and if they just happen to be, like, 25 pounds overweight for whatever reason, or they're bald, they're going to make that much less money and potentially not get to a certain level, having nothing to do with their intellect or content, but having everything to do with their appearance.
And
I'm not naive to it, but that's just screwed up to me I realize it exists, but man, it just feels screwy.
It's that way for women too, any female who works on TV. Having to be dressed to the nines, hair and makeup fully
right.
done every single day, that takes, I mean, I just can't even think about the time that takes. Like, I'm lucky that I can, that I don't have to be on camera, that I sit in front of a computer
right.
all day.
But look
day.
At Maggie. I mean, let's
yes,
not bullshit
absolutely.
It. So often, the first thing that Maggie probably gets judged on is her look,
her looks,
not what she's saying.
Oh,
and she's one of the smartest people here at SI.
Yes, absolutely.
So I obviously talk to a lot of people in the business. It's just, it's a ridiculously frustrating business on that end. But I give Steve Herz credit. A lot of people wouldn't even just be like, yeah, here's the honest deal, and that is the honest deal.
I will say being bald has not been a problem for Grant Wall yet. So
that's true. But therein lies my point, is that there he's being judged on his content. Although Grant does have a certain good, like, he has a look.
He does.
Like,
it's the Grant Wall look.
Yeah,
he looks very good.
Yeah,
he looks great on camera.
It's the Grant Wall look, exactly. All right, listen, enough about Grant Wall. All right, my thanks to Bet Marston, my thanks to our guests, and thank you to Dan Blum of Panoply, Ryan Hunt, Paul Fichtenbaum, Chris Stone, John Wertheim, Ben Eagle. Anyone else I need to give a shout-out to? Alan Kim, my second favorite producer now, Bet. You've risen back to the top. All right, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.